Are you a sports fan who didn't know the NFL draft was this week? Then boy, do I have the teaser trailer for you. I'm Danny Heifetz, and I host the Ringer NFL Draft Show every week with Danny Kelly, Ben Solak, and Craig Horlbeck. We're doing mock drafts before the draft. We're grading picks after the draft. Now, do we know which picks were good and who's going to go where? No, absolutely not. We can't predict the future. But people like hearing about it. Yeah, don't you? You sickos. So we talk about it anyway. So come listen to the Ringer NFL Draft Show. And guess what? If you like the draft, but you don't like me, you can go listen to the Ringer NFL Show with Kevin Clark and Nora Princiotti and our other NFL experts. Or you can go to NFLDraft.TheRinger.com to check out our massive draft guide. So come listen to the Ringer NFL Draft Show and the Ringer NFL Show on Spotify, because they employ me, or it's also available on all the other platforms that don't employ me.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
I'm Sean Fennessy, and this is the Prestige TV Podcast. We're going to be here every Sunday night recapping Barry. Who better to do it with than the writer, director, producer, star of the show, the great Bill Hader. Let's get right into our conversation about the first episode. So Bill Hader's here. We're talking about Forgiving Jeff. It's episode 1, season 3 of Barry. Very excited to have him. Before we get into the episode specifically, Bill, at the conclusion of season 2, how much did you know about where you wanted to take Barry Block's story going forward?
I think it was nothing, really. We didn't know anything. We just kind of season 2 ended and it was kind of like we had some ideas, but nothing concrete at all. And then, let's see. So we finished the episodes, I want to say, in early spring 2019 for season 2. And then we started back up writing season 3 in October of 2019. And then, so these episodes were, you know, first day of, you know, writing episode 1 of season 3 was kind of like, all right, so Cousineau knows. What do we think, you know? And I think very quickly that first meeting, I feel like I remember saying, we should get rid of the acting class and Cousineau, Barry should just know that Cousineau knows, and the end of the episode should be with him with a gun to Cousineau's head, you know, and like, let's just get right to it. Instead of, if I was watching the show, I would start to get a little antsy if it turns into kind of like a cat and mouse thing with Cousineau trying to get information and Barry doesn't know. And it, you know what I mean? It was just kind of like, let's just get to it. So I think, by doing that, it kind of, you know, the writers and I just felt this kind of permission to, you know, start kind of tearing it apart away. And it was kind of a bit like writing a new show because you didn't have the acting class. Everyone's in kind of different places, you know, especially the Sally character. And it was, you know, just more character focused, I think, you know.
Did you find yourself getting a little bored with the structure that you had built over those first two seasons?
I get bored very easily. yeah, you know, I think there was a piece of me that during season 2 was like, we're ending with another class show. like, we can't do this every season. Like, both season one and two ended with this class show thing, and it was like, you know, we got to do something different. So I think that was for sure a big part of it.
Before we get into the details of what you're doing here, I got to ask you, obviously this long period of time has transpired since people last saw the show. World's been in a pretty weird and dark place. The show is kind of impressively dark, but was there any part of you that was rethinking like the way you were pursuing the show or the tone of the show as all of this stuff was transpiring in the world?
No, you know, it never think of it in those terms. It kind of just is very intuitive, you know, but I will say that, you know, we wrote I want to say the first four episodes, and it outlines for the last four episodes of season three. And we had our first table read, and then like the next day the world shut down. And I think, you know, we were about a week away from shooting. And so during that time, that year and a half, I was just, you know, we kind of were mapping out what a season four could be, but in doing that was going back and rewriting season three. Actually, you know, the tentpole scenes and the tentpole moments were all there, but again, it was just kind of honing it and focusing it. And in doing that, especially I'll say in the later episodes this season, it did come out quite dark, but it felt, and I don't know if that was just being in the middle of this pandemic and the way, you know, politics were, and, you know, George Floyd and all these things that were happening while we were writing it. It has to seep in somehow, you know, but it wasn't a conscious thing, you know, but, again, it, you know, it was just kind of a intuitive feeling and an emotional feeling, kind of going, where are these characters at emotionally, and what makes sense kind of each step of the way. And so, yeah, that's where that came from.
So when we first see Barry this season, he looks a little different. He's like, a little more haggard. He's like simultaneously more blank and more deranged than ever. Mm-hmm. And then he does something extremely violent and kills two people kind of on a whim, it feels like.
Yeah, I mean, he's being paid for that job, but he ends up shooting the guy that who should be paying him. So he gets angry. I think it was, you know, there was a version of this that was very early on of Barry. You know, the original open of it was him, I want to say, at a gas station at night, and he's talking to a guy, and the guy wants his wife killed, and Barry says okay, and he gets the money from him. And then Barry kills that guy. And I remember the guy, he had his car in reverse, so the car starts to drift backwards. And I had this idea that the car would be drifting backwards, and Barry's kind of, we're dollying with Barry, tracking with Barry while the car is kind of next to him while it's moving. And it was this kind of long orchestrated tracking shot. And he, as he's walking, he's on the phone. He gets on the phone and it's to the wife, and he's like, it's done. So it's like, oh, the wife had paid him and he double crossed this guy, got money from him. And now so he's getting double the money for one hit. And, you know, it was interesting. And I was like, oh, I think the shot could be really interesting. It's at night in LA, and, you know, but it was all about that. It was kind of like, well, here's where he's at. You know, it didn't really have anything to do with, as you're writing the show, these themes start to come up, you know, of forgiveness and people apologizing and, you know, all this stuff. And it, you know, forgiveness has to be earned. And as I was trying to, you know, as we were doing that, that open started to feel not right. And so I remember going into my office and just writing that new version, which is what you see. And it being about, oh, let's have him kill the very idea of forgiveness. Like, it might be more interesting that he's supposed to kill this guy, and then the guy who hired him 1 minute is like, I want you to cut his eyelids off. And then less than 10 seconds later is like, hey, man, you know, let's call this off. I feel bad, you know? And it's like that guy has a thing that Barry doesn't have, you know, and it's a thing that he will never get, you know? You know, and he feels like he doesn't deserve it, or does he deserve it? And so it was a good place to do that. And then these other things started coming of like, when we found that location, it was like, oh, it'd be nice to have that tree in the background. And then you're hearing this guy saying, please forgive me. That's the first thing you hear, you know, please, please forgive me. And then Barry's just eating a donut deep in thought. And that right there tells a story, you know, oh, this is where he is now. You know, he can be having his breakfast while this guy is begging for his life, you know, right, you know, 30 yards away from him.
Yeah, you mentioned something interesting there that I wanted to ask you about, because when I was watching that scene, it's like, it's a little bit Miller's Crossing, it's a little bit Cormac McCarthy, you know, with the tree on the cliff. And you mentioned when you were originally conceiving the opening scene of this season that like a shot was appealing to you, that you were mm-hmm. like, I have a cool idea for how to shoot something. How much of that comes into it when you're in the writing process now, where you're like, I want to challenge myself as a filmmaker or whoever's yeah. directing the episode?
Yeah, it's just, I just like shots that tell a story. You know, and it's like, how can we tell a story through, you know, cinematically? And I think it's a thing, especially with television, that I think is an old kind of trope, is that it's not cinematic. You know, it's all about talking heads and stuff. And I would love to be able to, you know, I have the opportunity at HBO and everything is to try to make it as cinematic as I can, because that's kind of what I enjoy. So yeah, definitely when I'm writing this stuff, it's always like, what are the shots, you know, how can this tell a story? And a good example of the thing I was telling you before at the gas station, it was just a shot. It didn't really tell you anything. It was just kind of like, oh, well, you know, that's kind of interesting that, you know, maybe this thing's following him around and he can't get away from it or something. And that's, you know, with the car or whatever, but it just wasn't, again, it's like when I say tell a story, it's not like super didactic or something, you know, it's just a feeling, you know, it's like an emotional feeling, you know, and that opening thing initially was like, well, this is just kind of about the shot. It's not really about anything else, you know.
Is it up to you to self-edit that? Like, do you have to say I'm the, or like, yeah. Will Alec help you realize that? Or is it always you saying like, I'm not, this isn't the right idea?
It's usually me. It's usually me. Everyone else is like, yeah, it was great, man. You know, that's the hard thing, you know, that's the hard thing is everyone's usually like, awesome. You know, now when it comes terrible. To story stuff, when it comes to story stuff, Alec, Duffy Boudreaux, yeah, it's a different thing, you know, where you're reading the scripts going, hey, you know what? I just looked at this scene and I really don't know if this is deep enough, or are we saying the right thing here? Or is this really what it should, you know, what is the purpose of this? Mm. How does this move things forward? You know, that's a big thing we say a lot is like, well, what am I getting? What's the new information? You know, that's the thing that, you know, I've learned a lot from Alec and Liz Sarnoff because they have much more experience writing on television than I did when I started this thing. So it was kind of like, yeah, what's the, you know, what are we like everything has to kind of, you know, move the story forward, you know?
So speaking of that, I thought of this just as I was watching the opening minutes of the first episode. It's, you know, Barry is doing freelance assassin work, kind of harvested off the dark web, I guess. Is that a thing? Is that a thing that people, did you guys research that?
Yeah, it is a thing in the dark web. You can hire hitmen.
How did you come upon that? Did you
guys get into the dark web? I watch pretty much every true crime show on the planet. And I'm not watching like old movies. You know, it's like between old movies and true crime shows. That seems to be my Achilles heel. And it's funny, my whole family's that way. So, you know, my sisters, it's kind of the place, like if you have a thing on and it starts, my sisters and my dad and I can go, oh, I know this one. You know. Oh no, it's the brother. The brother sets up the husband's brother. He kills the wife and the brother. Yeah, this is crazy. And they catch him because you know, there was somehow gunpowder on his socks, you know.
It's an adorable family ritual.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But there was a thing about, I want to say a 48 Hours or a Dateline or something about a guy who, that you could find people on the web, you know, dark web, you could hire hitmen.
So it seems like your character and Sally, Sarah Goldberg's character, have kind of leveled up. You know, you're living together now in the show. She's writing and starring in a series based on her experience from her scene that she performed at the end of season two. How far ahead in the future are we? Has a lot of time passed?
Well, yeah, it's I think May says it, Detective May says it to Kusuna. I think it's been 6 months.
Okay, 6 months.
Yeah.
I was curious how you feel about the idea of people kind of leveraging their trauma for creative work in Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, everybody kind of has their own, some people do it and it's really, you know, they're playing themselves, you know? But I always found that I feel like the interesting, you know, art, you know, without sounding pretentious or whatever, but it is, you know, it does come out, when the more personal you make it, the more authentic it feels. It's kind of like having a conversation with someone. You can tell when someone's kind of, usually if someone's being, you know, being genuine or not, you know? So you can feel that in acting, and you could feel it in the writing. You could feel it in the direction. You know what I mean? So I don't think I'm somebody though, that if I did a thing about the actual, whatever, you know, having anxiety on SNL, that wouldn't be an interesting show about a guy, you know, on Saturday Night Live. I don't really have any sympathy for that guy, or I don't find it that interesting.
But that does make it sound like you made a show about all the murders you did, you know,
that's all the murders I did. I watched the true crime shows to see if I pop up on it. And I go, oh, I'm no, but I think it, you know, by making it a hitman and then trying to take the genre out of it and go, well, where do I emotionally kind of can fit into there? And it's, you know, and Alex doing the same thing, and Duffy Boudreaux doing the same thing. Like, we're all trying to go, you know, a lot of times in the writer's room, it almost could feel like a group therapy session, you know. Mm. It can be kind of very open of people talking about, you know, all the writers, Jason Kim, Emily Heller, Tao Kalade, Emma Barry, you know, all of them were, Liz Sarnoff, were all kind of saying, well, you know, one time I had this experience, you know, or this experience, and it's a very kind of safe zone to do that, because that's where the work gets. You know, when I was at South Park, we did that, you know, and sometimes at South Park, the idea would start in a place that was hyper offensive, you know, and it was almost a way of going like, well, here's the dumb idea. Let's all start doing the dumb, obvious, offensive version of it. And now it's like, okay, now we got that out of our system. What is this really? Do you know what I mean? And it's a messy experience. So it's like, I get it when people are doing that, where it's, you know, whether it's a singer or a painter or anything, where it's like, wow, that is directly from your life. And that is just naked, you know. I admire it, and it's interesting to watch, but or listen to, but me personally, I don't think my life's that interesting.
Well, on the flip side though, I feel like one of the best parts about this season so far is, you know, where the show used to be about people on the fringes of the industry, now you've got your characters are in the industry. They're making a TV show.
That was very important. Yeah, that was an important distinction of, now we have the world's opening up. And it's a bit like when you move to LA, I think. You move to LA and you don't know anybody. And the more you're at it, suddenly you're bringing people coffee, but now you're bringing, you know, Brian Grazer coffee, you know, or whoever. And you're like, whoa, you know, it's, you know, that happens. You start to kind of be in the orbit of bigger people, you know.
My favorite scene in this first episode is is that Elizabeth Perkins playing the network executive?
Yeah.
And she's looking at the footage of Joplin, and she immediately recalls a different scene from a different show that she had watched 5 minutes of probably earlier that day. And just the idea of like, I'm sure that you or people in your writer's room had probably a very similar experience.
Emma Barry and Liz Sarnoff kind of gave me, I remember I was in my car and I called them and I was like, what are bad notes you got? And they both, Liz said the one of this actress is good, but that could bite you in the ass. That is a thing she heard in an actual meeting. And then Emma, this one person would always say, they felt like they had to ask a question. And so they would ask like very obvious questions. And then, and so I wrote the thing of like, well, does a mother and daughter live together? You know? But then Elizabeth Perkins and Joanna Sotomura, who plays the assistant, is so funny in that. I mean, that's not supposed to be funny. When she goes, "Do you live with your mother?" And she goes, "I did." The way she says "I did" just killed us. It's so earnest. And Jesse Hodges is so funny in that, because I just said to Sarah and Jesse, you know, just kind of mumble your own experience with your mother. And so Jesse improvised like, "My mother died when I was," and then in the edit we had Elizabeth Perkins cut her off. But Elizabeth Perkins came in, it was another actor, and unfortunately that actor had to have surgery and had to step away. And so Elizabeth Perkins literally was hired on a Saturday and shot on Monday. It was crazy.
Pretty incredible. Shortly after that, we actually see Sally quickly assuming the role of the talent and like treating her friend, who is also her assistant, badly. And the Darcy Sally character is super interesting. Yeah, it's like what you're doing with her and what Sarah's doing in the performance is really interesting, because she's obviously a person that like we have a lot of empathy for, but you've always been unafraid to show her flaws and her, you know, egocentrism in the character too. And this year it feels like it's kind of amped up.
Yeah, because she's making it, you know, and she has a lot to lose. And, you know, she's interesting because she's actually good. But, you know, this kind of her, whatever, I never think that she's mean. She's just in her mind, she's being honest, you know. So we always have to write it from the standpoint of like, it's honest. You can't, you know, when Sarah says that line of, can you cut up those carrots for me? I just love the way that you do it. If she does it smarmy, you know what I mean? It doesn't work. But if she does it just genuine, like she thinks she's giving a compliment, it works, you know? And so I think Sarah really understands the character in that way of like, here's how you modulate this to make it not feel like, that she's like a total monster all the time.
Was one of the appealing things about doing this storyline for Sarah's character, doing a little bit of the Francois Truffaut day for night, here's what it's like in my life every day as the showrunner star?
I mean, the big Warner shot in that is very much kind of autobiographical in a way of, well, here's what it's like, you know, here's what it looks like when you get exactly what you dreamed, you always dreamed you wanted, you know, you always wanted to be directing. For me, it was like, man, I just want to be directing. This is what I've always wanted, you know. And then you get it, and it's very overwhelming, you know, and it's a lot of pressure on you. And then when you're acting on it, it's a whole other pressure. And so it was nice for me to kind of, you know, the Warners I like always kind of tell a story, and it was nice to try to do that with this, where, you know, I just thought, oh, when I enter on the stage, I always feel very small. And the stage and the sets feel so big. And there's this feeling of like, oh, I'm like in charge of this, you know, but it's so big. So it was purposely like, let's start where she's very small in the frame. And then she enters this kind of tableau of her past. And then she has to kind of, with detachment, watch these two stunt people reenact one of the worst moments of her life. And then as you're doing that, you're slowly pushing in, and then it slowly becomes subjective. You know, it goes very objective, and then you get really subjective, where then you go into darkness and she has a moment to breathe, and then the being the silhouette, the red light. And my favorite moment of that whole shot actually is when she goes in and she hugs Elsie Fisher and the camera's right over her shoulder and you see the hair and makeup people and Elsie Fisher, and then the AD steps in. It's just so claustrophobic. And then every move wanted to reveal new things. So as she moves to the bed, you see all the network, everybody over at the, you know, at Video Village, and everyone's on their phones. And I don't have that at HBO, but it's like, you know, you have that over there and you have the, you know, cameras right in your face and you're trying to remember your lines and they're spraying shit in your hair and all this stuff. And it was just a lot of fun. And that was the very first day of shooting, first day of shooting. And Gavin Kleintop, our first AD, was like, if we do this, this will like just bring everybody together, you know, and it'll make a big sense of accomplishment for the crew. And it was, we rehearsed it one day and the next day just came in and shot it. And I think you're seeing we did 16 takes and that's take 16.
Oh, wow. Incredible. I mean, it's an amazing act of choreography. Yeah.
So when she says, well, how long is the impression you have sex? Like, you know, as she's talking, I think we cut. And if I let that play an extra like 5 seconds, you hear the whole crew like erupt in applause because everyone was like, we got it, you know.
I was curious if you related to the kind of stage managing that Sally's trying to do during this period too, of like, look at how perfect my personal life is and my boyfriend comes with flowers. Like, do you have those anxieties as somebody who's in that role?
Not really, no. I think on set, I mean, I don't think anybody assumes I have a personal life.
You're like the teacher in high school.
Yeah. I'm a teacher in high school. It's like seeing your teacher at a grocery store and you're like, what am I, dad? What's going on? No, I've never felt that. But that was always a funny thing of bring me flowers. And that was a reshoot. We went back and reshot Barry buying the flowers. That was initially not in there. And Amy Gravitt said, you know, I think it'd be nice to see him buy those flowers. And I knew what she meant by that, you know? And then I was like, oh yeah, he's on the phone with someone wanting to be murdered. And he asked them about like flowers. I got that. Like it kind of, yeah. You know what I mean? If I could say it eloquently, I wouldn't make it, but it's like, it's a feeling you have, you know? And that's Aida Rogers, our producer, who's the woman on the phone. She did a great job.
She's really funny when she loses her shit when you are distracted. It's like, yeah, you hired me to kill someone for you. Yeah, so yes, I am. This is the introduction to the gunshot visual that we see, the blood coming out of Sally's head, and the sound cuts out while Barry's speaking to her. And you know, it's a pretty bold choice, and there's always been a little bit of kind of like, I don't know, what would you call it, like absurdity or magical realism or something, where we're kind of getting into Barry's psyche throughout the show over the years. But it does feel like this is the big signpost of like, we're entering a descent into madness. Like, what was the thinking behind that decision?
Yeah. And it's also very kind of, it's like a trope that you've seen, you know, it's like Macbeth, it's in Macbeth, you know? Mm-hmm. And even that film Possessor does it, you know, where he's seen shit that's not there. And, you know, so it's a pretty well-worn kind of trope of somebody watching, you know, but the idea of them being shot in the head, and the sound, you know, initially shot and scripted, it was like the scene is going on and they keep getting shot. So it was like squibs going off on everybody. And the idea was that it just, everything felt normal, but they were being shot. And it was this thing we tried and then we got an edit and it just did not work at all. And so Frankie Gutman, the editor, and I decided like, oh, what if we just make it four headshots for her and Cousineau And when you shoot, like the sound goes out in this tea kettle. And then Dave Wingo, our composer, was like, what if we do this tea kettle thing, you know? And it just worked great.
Yeah, it works really well. Which takes us to the other person who we see the gunshot on, Gene's in a tough spot. He's in a bad place in this episode, and it's an interesting challenge for Henry too, because I feel like Henry got reintroduced again as someone that we love in our culture by playing Gene over the last couple of seasons, and now it's almost like a different character. Like, what was your thinking with putting him together this season?
Well, there's something that happens to these characters where they kind of, when something terrible happens, they kind of go, you know, at the end of two, he's kind of comatose. You know, he kind of goes to, he's not fully himself. You know, he just saw the woman that he loves, you know, dead. And so, you know, he's trying to, and he knows it's Barry. Or he's pretty sure it's Barry. The more he kind of plays it out in his head, it's like, yeah, obviously it's Barry. So, yeah, I mean, Henry still manages to get big laughs, though, even when he's doing this stuff. We always write things incredibly straight and dramatic. And then it's like, again, I get bored and we start adding humor because I just start to get bored. And so, like, even that scene with him and Sarah Burns and Gary Krause, we added the thing of, you know, could you say the Raven, and he echoes what everyone, the what, you know, like, and he did a bunch of different takes of that, and all of them were really funny. And him looking at his gun, it's like, oh, let's make sure there's like a little card from Rip Torn there, and to just, you know, it's just leveling out the thing a bit, you know, but he's playing it like he's in a drama, which is important.
The dictated but not read note on the Rip Torn card is
glad you
the
like
funniest
that.
Gag.
No one else found that funny.
It's really fucking funny.
That was the part that made me laugh the hardest, and everyone else was like, oh yeah, dictated, remember, whatever. And I'm like, that's so funny that he dictated that to some poor assistant.
The idea of someone working for Rip Torn at that time in general is just funny.
Yeah, too, and being like, fire this off to Cousineau. And it's for a gun. So it was just making me laugh that Rip Torn handed some assistant a gun and said, take a letter. Like, that's funny.
It's really brilliant. NoHo Hank emerged as a hardcore fan favorite on the show. Obviously this season he is, he's in a different place, and he's in love and dating. And I don't think people were predicting this necessarily. What were you thinking about? Is Hank one of those characters who like was supposed to not continue to be on the show, but then Anthony was so good?
Yeah. Anthony Kerrigan was just so funny, and what he did was so funny that we didn't kill him in the pilot. He was supposed to die. And then it was like Alec and I just said, oh, we'd be crazy to kill this guy. But yeah, you know, when we were talking about season three, it was like, well, Cristobal and Hank, it seemed like that was happening. You know, and it was kind of jokey, and it was like, well, let's make it real. And it's like a real, and it's a full relationship now, but they're hiding, you know, they're like, kind of like what Barry does. It's a secret life, you know, and in Cristobal's case, it's like a double secret life, you know? So that was really important, and to show it that they're really in love. And then I think, you know, it was like, oh, we need, you know, the writer's room, we all were talking about, it was like, it'd be great if we had like an actually healthy relationship, semi-healthy, like just an actual two people actually in love with each other in the show. And that it was like a Romeo and Juliet type thing, you know?
Yeah. And he also gets to kind of underscore the theme, at least it seems like, of this episode, if not the whole season, of forgiveness has to be earned, which you mentioned already.
Yeah. Liz Sarnoff came up with that like towards right, like in prep for season three. Like that line came in very late, and she was like, yeah, it's kind of like forgiveness has to be earned. And I was like, that's it.
One last thing on this before we wrap up this episode. So one thing I've always loved about this show, I assume people tell you this, is this show is 30 minutes long and seasons are 8 episodes, and it is, you can wrap your arms around it. It's clear what you're getting. But as you build out the show, you're into the third season. You mentioned Hank was supposed to die, but he didn't die. You have kind of more mouths to feed in the story, and the world is getting bigger now. Is it harder to keep it this kind of tight little beautiful machine?
Yeah, you know, you're constantly cutting stuff. And then, you know, if anything, it kind of goes back to what you were saying in terms of, you know, shots and stuff. You have to be just really hard on the material and kind of say, like, what matters, what doesn't, you know. And, you know, our whole thing is always like, how's this move the plot along? And it's funny because we'll write, I was talking to Hiro Murai about this, where it's like, you always feel like you've underwritten it. And then you shoot it all and you get in and you're like, we have way too much stuff. We have to cut a bunch of stuff, you know? So I think because I've now had the experience of two seasons, and then even during the third season, as we were doing the third season, you know, in the middle of production, kind of going, yeah, we don't need that. We don't need that. It can go right from here to here. You know, I feel like I had that confidence to, you know, to say that. And I think, you know, Alec as well, it was like, kind of like, oh, we know what the show is, you know? So, and I tend to shoot not a lot of coverage and not a lot of takes. It's always very kind of, you know, again, it's like from watching a lot of old movies, it's just this very, you know, the thing I've said ad nauseum is simple dynamic coverage of just interesting shots. And I mean, I think this season what we try to do more is this kind of, you know, where you know, one shot can turn into another, one nicely composed shot will turn into another nicely composed shot, you know, or blocking was a bigger thing, you know, you watch like, you know, Polanski was really good at blocking. You know, like, or those Polish movies in general, they do really interesting blocking in them. So, you know, just watching that stuff, but I bring that up because that in and of it way keeps it tight, you know, doing everything in one kind of weirdly keeps it. You're like honing these scenes and then those scenes become shots that you're honing, you know? And then it just hopefully will just string together. And that's why the edit is always so nerve-wracking, because you want to see if it works. And then you get in there and you're like, oh my God, we undershot this. Oh boy, I'm a fucking idiot.
It doesn't seem that way at all. It honestly makes it easy to prepare for conversations like this, because it's just like, oh, that's when this happens and that's when there's flow, which is probably what you're looking for. Yeah, you
gotta have a flow. And I just like stories like that. I mean, don't get me wrong, I like movies that feel messy and kind of, you know, but I still feel like this has that, but it still feels lived in. It's not, there's nothing kind of, I don't know, OCD about it or whatever. It's just more honed. It's like a constant feeling of honing and focusing, going like, is that really what this is about? No, it's really about this. Let's, you know, and you know, we did 2 weeks of reshoots in February, you know, and that again was going back to scenes that didn't really work, or that you know, we wrote wrong, and things that we thought were important that weren't, and you know, so well, when we hit maybe those,
I was gonna say maybe as through the course of the season you can point out some things that kind of materially changed at when you
100%, and it's to that point of like, this feels like a tangent, or this isn't really what would happen. And it usually just came down to like logic and where the people were at in the story. Like, you know, oh, we're imposing this. The characters aren't imposing this. We want to talk about this, you know, or we want a big comedy scene here, and it just wouldn't work. You know, it's like, no, this is what the scene should be.
Okay. Well, let's wrap episode one there. When we come back next week, we'll talk about what Barry's plan actually is to redeem himself and earn forgiveness.
It's stupid.
Thank you to Bill Hader. Thank you, of course, to our producer, Bobby Wagner, for his work on this episode. If you dug this conversation, stay tuned. Next Sunday, we'll be talking again about Barry, episode 2, with Bill Hader. See you then.